You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, March 18th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Susan Goldman, writer for or contributing editor to 972 magazine and Israel-Palestine analyst at New America on the election in Israel that Bibi Netanyahu, I don't know if it's fair to say, but it's pretty close, walked away with in many respects. After having thrown off the fig leaf of a two-state solution early in the week and essentially saying that, well, it raises a lot of questions. We will talk about that. But also being sort of almost nakedly racist against Israeli Arabs. Also on the program today, Aaron Schock. Bye-bye. No shock. But shocking, Donald Trump, he could be jumping into the race just in time for Chris Christie to have another scandal on his plate, I guess, so to speak. No pun intended. Also on the program, yeah, I know. Pentagon loses $500 million worth of military hardware in Yemen. What's 500 mil? And a series of troubling climate stories. And I don't spend much time, you know. And the danger of leaving our political discourse to late night talk show hosts. Yes. All that and more. Yes, and Mike Huckabee still promoting cinnamon for diabetes. I mean, I don't know that I would say if you have diabetes, don't eat cinnamon. But
all I can say,
I think you got to maintain your expectations.
All I can say is I have to speed up my career transition to go into Republican politics.
Oh,
there is so much money to be made. It's
well, I mean, those guys. I mean, just think about the guys who are working for Donald Trump. All right, but before we get there, folks, some good news. I mentioned this briefly yesterday, but Oregon Governor Kate Brown on Monday signed the first bill in the country, the first law, or signed a bill into law, which will establish the first law in the country that will automatically register voters using their driver license data. And apparently she was excited about this because she is the one who introduced the bill as a lawmaker and championed the legislation when she was Secretary of State. You'll recall that she was recently became governor because the last governor had to step down because of a scandal dealing with his payments, or I guess hiring his fiance. So, but this is good news. Voter registration now more cost effective, more secure, more convenient for Oregonians, she said. So why wouldn't we? Under House Bill 2177, Oregonians who obtain or renew their driver's license or state identification cards will also provisionally register to vote if they haven't already. These prospective new voters will be notified and given 21 days to opt out of registering. It's going to be fascinating to see how much of an impact this has on voting numbers and how many people actually come out to vote. No reason not to do this. Absolutely no reason not to do this, unless, of course, you're a Republican congressman or congressional candidate and you want to keep as many people from voting as possible, because that's one of the bigger arrows you have in your quiver. And speaking of quiver, I am a quiver at the moment, because, ladies and gentlemen, we have in just 2 short days, right? We've only been doing this for 2 days. This is the third day. We have achieved 23% of our goal on Indiegogo. So I want to thank all of you who have contributed so far, and please pass it around to folks. It's a great way to get people interested in the show, in addition to supporting the show. If you are a freebier and have never wanted to make a commitment to become a member of the show, but you're starting to feel like, you know what, I listen to the thing every day, or 3 days a week, or 2 days a week, or once a week for years now, or months now, or weeks now, I'm going to go over there and plunk something down and get one of those fancy schmancy perks. Now's the time to do it. Head over to Indiegogo and search The Majority Report, or you can just go to themajorityreport.com. Themajorityreport.com, and it will bring you right to our Indiegogo page. Appreciate all the support you can give. Pass it around if you've already given, but if you have given, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Come back with Lisa Goldman. She is a contributor to 972 Mag and an Israel-Palestine analyst with New America on the implications of this. And I can tell you, this election is fascinating to me, less because of the internal dynamics in Israel and more about the implications it's going to have for American policy towards Israel. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Lisa Goldman. She is a contributing editor to 972 Magazine and an Israel-Palestine analyst for the New America Foundation. Welcome to the program, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
So the results are in, and I guess to the extent that people had expectations in the Israeli elections, it's a it's a little bit of a surprise. Is that a fair characterization?
I think a lot of people were surprised, but they should not have been surprised. I think that the numbers were on Netanyahu's side all along. The surprise for me was the really big gap between the exit polls and the final results. And when the exit polls were published at about 10 p.m. Israel time, the Zionist Union and Likud were tied with 27 seats. A little, maybe 28, 27, but basically 27 each. And Israelis went to bed, and by the time they woke up, presto, the Zionist Union had 24 seats and the Likud had 30. And its natural allies for a coalition had the numbers so that Netanyahu would easily be able to cobble together a governing coalition. And the media, I was listening to the 6 a.m. news broadcast from Israel, and the announcers were calling it a landslide victory.
Okay, so the Israeli politics are far more, I think, I don't know if it's fair to say complicated, but at the very least, they're definitely more complicated when it comes from an electoral standpoint. And so break it down for us, for those people who don't have much of a familiarity with the internal politics. We have Likud at 30 seats and Zionist Union at 24, and then the joint list at 14. I mean, walk us through this. Likud, I think most people are familiar with that party. It is the... I guess the right-wing party is not the furthest right-wing party.
No, it's not. It's not at all. It's a libertarian. Traditionally, it was founded in the 19... It was originally founded as a straightforward libertarian sort of party, economically speaking. And I guess you could call it a right-wing party in terms of its territorial ambitions. Its party platform calls for both sides of the Jordan and so forth. There are parties that are far to the right of Likud.
Okay, and then walk us through the Zionist Union.
Right. Okay, so I guess your listeners probably should know going into this conversation that the governing system in Israel is a unicameral parliamentary system. So you have one house, it's a parliamentary system, and it's a fragmented system. There are 120 seats in the Knesset, and the head of a governing coalition, the prime minister, has to have a coalition of at least 61 seats. You have to have a majority of 61 seats out of 120 to be the head of the government. Now, if your party wins the most seats, that does not necessarily mean that you're going to be prime minister. You don't have enough seats on your own to form a government. So if you have 30 or 40 seats, you still need another... if you have 40 seats, 21 more seats. So you need to put together a coalition with natural allies or with people that you can promise something to. So, another party might have more seats but fewer natural allies and wouldn't be able to find the numbers to form a coalition. So Netanyahu not only has the most seats, but he's also in a good position to put together a coalition. On previous occasions, he actually did not win the most seats, but was in the best position to put together a coalition. Now, besides the Likud, there's the Zionist Union. That's the second largest party at the moment. It's composed of the Labour Party, which is headed by Isaac Herzog, who's often called Bushi, and Hatznua, which is headed by Tzipi Livni. And that is a very small party. I think it has three or four seats. I don't remember exactly. And together they won 24 seats. So they were seen as the sort of liberal left of center alternative to the hawkish right-wing Likud party. Then you have the surprise newcomer, which is the joint list. In Israel, it's the Israeli Hebrew media usually refers to it as the Arab party or as the joint Arab list. This is a party that was just formed a few months ago during this campaign, and it combines all the parties that traditionally represented various sectors of the Arab-Palestinian vote. There is 20% of the population of Israel is Arab-Palestinian. Now, these are not people living under occupation in the West Bank. They're not people who have Israeli identity cards but are stateless and live in East Jerusalem. And they're not residents of Gaza either. These are straightforward Israeli citizens who are of Palestinian extraction. They've been citizens since 1948. They have formed a party that is composed of Hadash, which is the or Jabha, which is the Arabic name, and that's the Jewish Arab Socialist Party. That's the largest one. It's headed by Ayman Oude, who's also the head of the party. It's also there's also Balad, which is a secular Palestinian nationalist party, and then there are two Islamist parties as well. So they before were like four separate parties sitting in the Knesset, each with three or four seats. The new legislation would have made it impossible to sit in the Knesset unless your party got a minimum of five seats, which would have been that none of the Arab parties would have gotten seats in Knesset. So they all got together and made one party.
And this was legislation that was pushed, if I'm not mistaken, by Avigdor Lieberman with the idea of keeping Arab parties out.
That's correct. And it worked. It just in a very strange, very kind of Hollywood style form of justice, it sort of worked against him. His party was polling very, very low all through the campaign. And his numbers were so low that a lot of people thought he might become a victim of his own legislation because he was just barely polling at five seats. He did squeak through. He's got six seats. But the joint list, which is otherwise called the Arab Party, as I said, is now the third largest party in the Knesset.
And the fourth largest party is Yesh Atid. What can you tell us about that?
Yesh Atid, it means there is a future. And it's headed by a journalist named Yair Lapid. Yair Lapid was a sort of a popular television show host, kind of like, I guess, an Israeli version of Jon Stewart, not nearly as clever, but he was a popular guy. He had a primetime interview show with that same format as most of these American evening shows with, musical guests and other guests. And he was a well-known figure. His father, Tommy Lapid, was a Hungarian Holocaust survivor who was a very prominent journalist for many, many years. And then he founded a party that also had the same sort of very secular, anti-religious, pro-business, pro-European, very middle-class center of the country, Tel Aviv sort of attitude. And it came out of nowhere in 2003, won 13 seats, and then it was a flash in the pan. And Yesh Atid basically came out of nowhere with a very similar platform, won a whole lot of votes last time. And Lapid ran partly on the campaign of this economic situation in Israel, whereby people cannot afford, the cost of living has far, far, far outpaced salaries. So you have dual income professional couples unable to afford to buy an apartment. So he sort of campaigned on promises to change that situation. If he were finance minister, he did become finance minister. He did not change the situation. And he's now, he's lost a lot of popularity. But he's still got a pretty fair number of votes. He's doing pretty well. And he probably will join the new governing coalition.
Okay, so let's talk about, and then there's a couple other parties, Kulanu.
Right.
Bayit Yehud, which is sort of the more, I guess, the settler party.
Right.
And then Avigdor Lieberman's party, Yisrael
Bayinu.
And then an Orthodox party and one or two others. But give us a sense of what we can anticipate. And we should say also that is it the case that you don't necessarily get to, how is it determined that you get to attempt to form a coalition government?
Well, as I said, you have to prove yourself that you're in a position to form a governing coalition. And what happens is that
ahead. I'm sorry.
So the president, who's the titular head of state, it's basically ceremonial role, sort of like the Queen of England, but it's an unelected position. The president has the job of choosing which party leader gets first crack at forming a coalition. So you get about a month to form a coalition. So presumably, the president, Reuven Rivlin, will go to Netanyahu and say, right, you've got a month or you've got 6 weeks. let's see what you can do, form a coalition. And then it's up to Netanyahu to go out and talk to all his potential coalition partners and say, you know, here's what I'm offering you. You can be, you know, the head of the party can be finance minister, and you can have two other senior members of the party sitting in the cabinet with a portfolio if you'll sit in my government. It's horse trading. It goes on for like a month. And if he fails, after like a month or so, then the president will say, will turn to the next largest party and say, okay, it's your turn to try.
And because Netanyahu won so, I guess, resoundingly, there's really no controversy over this, right? I mean, if it was 24-24, 25-24 or something like that, then maybe the president has some wiggle room. But in this instance, this is basically it, right?
That's basically it. I mean, there was it was put about that Rivlin's preference was for a national unity government, but this was before the final results were announced. And, you know, there's no reason for Netanyahu to agree to a national unity government at the moment. But at the time, it looked as though the smaller parties were polling very, very low and might even not pass the threshold. And it also looked as though the Likud would get far fewer seats. And so it would be a sort of a natural thing for the president to say to the Zionist Union and Likud, I think you fellows should try to work out an agreement whereby you could form a joint national unity government. But that didn't happen.
Okay, so my sense is, and tell me if this is correct, and please elaborate on it, but that the government that Netanyahu forms is going to be even more to the right than the one that he had prior.
Well, yeah, it'll be very right wing. He's he'll probably have the religious parties in his coalition, as well as Naftali Bennett's party, which is the Jewish home religious settler oriented party. And he'll have Kahlon, which is we didn't talk about Kahlon, but he's actually, he's a very genial guy. He's a former Likudnik, very pro-business. He used to be Minister of Communications at one point, I think. And he formed his own party. He became a bit of a kingmaker by winning 10 seats. And he's a natural ally of Likud's. So, yeah, it'll probably be a fairly right-wing government. It's hard to say that it will be more right-wing than the last government, but it is true that each of the successive governments that Netanyahu has put together since he was elected in 2009 has been progressively more extremely right-wing.
And so we're looking at Likud with 30, Kahlon with 10.
10.
The settler party with 8, and then maybe Avigdor Lieberman's party
Oh yeah.
And
Lieberman's party as well. So let's just do the numbers quickly. You've got 30 for Likud. And then you've got Yesh Atid, that's 11. You've got 41 there.
Okay.
And then you've got another 10, which from Kulane, which is 51. And then by Yehudi. So he's in a very good position, Netanyahu, to form a coalition.
And so let's talk about what we can expect. Well, I guess let's talk about, I guess, the sort of the implications of how Netanyahu won. A couple of days ago, he came out and basically said no two-state solution. And
right.
Now the implications that a lot of people say, well, this is not that big of a deal. We already knew this. But I want you to talk about the implications of two things. One, what does it mean to say no two-state solution from his perspective? And then we'll talk about what it's going to mean sort of in terms of foreign policy. But from his perspective, there's a lot more to it than just no two-state solution, right? Because it goes to the heart of whether or not Israel maintains its so-called democratic character.
Right, but I really don't think that he's thinking about that. Most Israelis have shifted to the right. Israel is a pretty right-wing society. And what that means is kind of amorphous. It's difficult to explain. It doesn't mean people are sitting around sharpening their knives and saying, when can I go and kill an Arab? It's just not the case. I think it's pretty accurate to say that most Israelis are generally afraid of Arabs. They generally want to maintain Israel as a Jewish state, as a place that they can identify with, as a Jewish majority state. And when they think about what it means to have a majority, like if Israel were to maintain indefinite control over the West Bank, let's leave Gaza aside for now, just the West Bank, then, you know, quite soon there's going to be a majority Arab population under Israeli control, most of them living either as second-class citizens in Israel or as disenfranchised residents or citizens, if they're not citizens, in the West Bank. People haven't really thought about what that means. You know, there's this very emotional conversation about religious, about places of religious importance, like the Jewish holy places in the old city, which used to be, and which before 1967 was under Jordanian control, or about, you know, Rachel's tomb in Hebron, and you know, there, a lot of people talk about, you know, most of the events in the Old Testament take place in the Bible, and even sort of not very religious people have this sort of emotional attachment to those places that they don't really talk about. And then there's just this non-religious, very hawkish idea that, you know, if we evacuate from the West Bank, then the Palestinians will collude with Islamist extremists and they'll set up, you know, missile rocket launchers overlooking Tel Aviv. You know, we can't afford that risk to our security. But so people don't really think too much about those fears. It's just enough, I think, for Netanyahu to repeat them often enough. And it's quite remarkable that you have, you know, tough, hardened, experienced heads and high-ranking members of all of the branches of Israel's security services. I'm talking about military intelligence, the Shin Bet, which is domestic intelligence, and the Mossad, which is Israel's spy agency. And they've all said that, you know, we need to talk to Hamas. We need to, it's not a security risk to withdraw from the West Bank. We need to withdraw from the West Bank. Iran does not present an immediate threat to Israel. And it doesn't matter how often these guys make these statements. Netanyahu just has to swoop in and say, Iran, 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 ISIS, Palestinian, Hamas, rockets, and people just quail. And that's pretty much how he got reelected.
But what I don't understand is how there is no conversation. Well, I'm not, maybe no conversation is overstating it, but mm-hmm. if Netanyahu comes out and says no two-state solution, mm-hmm. but simultaneously also says, and maybe this is just implicit, but I think it's explicit, Israel will always retain its Jewish identity. Which necessarily follows. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize, like, okay, that means that permanent occupation, but never allowing any citizenship for these people.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand how is it just something that is like, there's some belief that like, oh, we could live like this forever. I mean, that isn't that announcing on some level, like, this is sort of like, I mean, I know this is inflammatory to some people, but this is like an apartheid state. Like, this is the permanent setup. We have we have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who are just going to be permanent second-class citizens. And people are just like, I'm not really thinking about that much.
Right. That's right. And when I talk about this issue, it's, what I try to do is to hit that sweet spot between saying, you're absolutely right, this is a completely insane, untenable situation, and people need to, and the people who are ignoring it really need to wake up. But on the other hand, I don't want people to think that Israelis are like uniquely blind to the realities of the world they live in. Everyone is, because it's called survival. And if you, for example, if you look around America, how is it that people are, you know, people ever thought it was a good idea to invade Iraq, for example? Or how is it that most people in this country actually think that it's better to pay for private health insurance than have the government provide it, when every normal functioning industrialized democracy in the Western world has a government administered one single payer healthcare system that functions very well, thank you very much. And I say that as a Canadian. So people are not that rational. They go by their emotions, and it's very difficult for them to examine why they feel a certain way when the logic right in front of them contradicts their feelings.
Well, I mean, I understand that. And you know, I can understand that for a certain extent of time, and I can understand it, you know, but now we've really lifted off the sort of the fig leaves here, right? I mean, because the support for our Iraq endeavor, I agree with you. It was insane in this country after 9/11 for 3 or 4 years, and the American public was willing to buy anything. With that said, we didn't have ex-CIA or ex-military leaders or military leaders coming out and saying, like, this is a huge mistake. I mean, we had really just, you know, somebody who was on MASH was literally allowed to come on TV and say that. And you know, this has been going on for quite some time. And it doesn't seem like, I mean, I agree with you. If there was, the analogy would make a little more sense to me, and maybe the threat is just larger, or the perception of the threat is larger. But I guess one wonders how much. Let me ask you this: how much longer do you think it's sustainable? I mean, that there'll be a majority of the Israeli population who will think this is a choice that makes sense?
I don't know. I don't think people are going to have that conversation until it's painful.
Right.
And the occupation just isn't hurting individual Israelis right now. What's really hurting individual Israelis right now is the fact that Israel has the widest income gap in the OECD. And that, you know, that professional dual income couples can't even get through the month. These are the things that worry Israelis. The fact that the school system is collapsing, the healthcare system is undermined. And also don't forget that America is a huge country. You can travel for days and days and days in your car and you will not hit a border.
Right.
And Israel has gone to war 3 times. You have general conscription, which means that every single family in Israel has a brother, son, and father in the army, and going into reserves until their mid-40s. And people feel afraid. They feel afraid.
I appreciate that, and I do think that notion is underappreciated in this country. And before I get to sort of the implications of that for this country, but what you just said about the financial situation is also, I find, surprising, because you know, it doesn't seem like Netanyahu really is either has on a sort of a practical level or on an ideological level situated to address those type of populist economic concerns. Is it just that the security issues trump the fear of Arabs? I mean, I know you translated his Facebook post from the other day, basically saying, like, the Arabs are coming out to vote now. And you know, we certainly have that in this country. I mean, you know, Tad Cochran won despite the fact that his opponents are like, this is all about the black people coming out to vote. So, you know, that dynamic, I feel like is a little bit more accessible to Americans.
Yeah.
But this notion, I mean, was it just simply that these populist issues, economic populist issues, were just overcome by the security? Or are there any of the right-wing parties that are more supportive of the social safety net that people thought, he'll form, you know, Avigdor Lieberman, he's a fascist, but he's really good on social safety net or whatever it was?
Well, that's the question that had confused, I think, the analysts and the pollsters going through the campaign, because whenever reporters for television and radio would go out to do those man on the street interviews, people would just talk about the economy and say, oh, for God's sake, you know, we're so sick of talking about Iran and security. We just need to talk about how we can pay the bills. And in fact, the most popular and widely shared election campaign clips on Facebook and on YouTube were the ones that addressed the financial situation, or people complaining bitterly about having to spend, you know, 2 weeks' salary to fill their car with gas and things like that. So that was why a lot of the, and of course the Zionist Union did campaign a lot on the economy. So that's why a lot of people looking at the numbers saying, okay, Zionist Union is doing better in the polls than Likud. And most of the media reports that focus on man on the street interviews are focusing on the economy as well and economic woes as well. Therefore, the economy is going to prove a more decisive issue for voters than security. Things are shifting in Israel. And I think that Netanyahu just really, really understands his base. Best of all, like, he really gets it. It's very true that people are depressed and that there's rising poverty and horrible income inequality and a decline in social welfare services. All of these things are very, very true. But it turns out that all Netanyahu had to do was spend 2 days sending automated messages to everyone's mobile phones and publishing these and uploading these 30-second clips about security fears to his Facebook page and telling people you have to get the vote out because, you know, the Arabs are coming to vote in droves and you've got to come and vote. The leftists are the ones that are conspiring with foreign money. Get out the Arab vote. This could be very dangerous. It could undermine the right-wing government. So make sure that you come out to vote. Don't vote for any party except for me because I'm the only one that stands between you and a left-wing government that will divide Jerusalem and give everything to the Arabs. That kind of really cheap, low-level populist talk sounds ludicrous to our ears, okay? But it worked. And he knew it.
I got to say, I follow the Republican primary every year, and so it doesn't sound that alien to me, to be honest with you. I mean, it's a fairly it's a formula that we certainly are familiar with in this country, and it works for, you know, maybe not quite half the population, but a significant percentage of them. All right, so let's talk about this. Okay, so let's just stipulate that the Israeli population, they were motivated by these factors for better or for worse. I would argue for worse, but be that as it may. Now, where does that leave the relationship with the United States? Because it seems to me that I am definitely of at least in, you know, sort of. The people I'll see at my Seder, let's say, when I go home in a week or two, I am to the left of many of those people. But I have.
I'm shocked.
Well, I know that's not shocking. I have to say that there's a lot of them just on, you know, just I'm taking a very unscientific random email sampling that the way in which Netanyahu won. By basically those two factors, saying there will never be a Palestinian state, and all the implications of that, you know, the Arabs are coming, and by Arabs he's not talking about the Arab nationals are coming, these countries. It's our fellow citizens who happen to be of Arab descent are coming.
Well, that's why it was just so horrific.
Yes,
you know, because Netanyahu was simultaneously boasting about Israel's vibrant democracy that provides equal rights for everyone. He even had his foreign ministers and his ambassadors boasting about how Israel is the safest place for Arabs to live in the whole Middle East, you know. And they were counting on a co-opted, passive, low turnout amongst Arab voters, and that just turned out to be not the case.
Now, so here's the question. The Palestinians, who now have every reason to believe, the Palestinian Authority has every reason to believe that they do not have a negotiating partner across the table now.
And that's, well, they knew that already.
Well, they knew that already, but now they have a very easy argument, don't they?
Yeah.
Because now they have the equivalent of what a lot of right wingers will talk about, like, it's in the charter. They don't recognize Israel. Well, it's now in the charter of the Israeli government too, isn't it? That we do not recognize the Palestinian people. We will never recognize the Palestinian people. Now what happens? They have no choice, obviously, even though, yes, this was the case in fact before, but, you know, a lot of this has to do with perception. They go to the UN and they start trying to get unilateral recognition of Palestinian statehood. Can the U.S. now veto that? I mean, is it going to be tenable Now that it's quite clear that there's no fig leaf here, right? There's no pretending anymore. And yes, many people who are very much, you know, knee deep in the policy and were savvy about this stuff knew this. But I can tell you, my aunt, she didn't know this. And at the Seder, it's going to be very hard for her to argue anything other than that. And now my aunt doesn't control the policy apparatus of the United States, I can assure you. But but with that said, I mean, I have a feeling this is going on around the country.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it is. I've been receiving some very interesting emails from various friends lately. You know, Jews who just were reflexively supportive of Israel because that's what Jews do, and they're now having to reassess that. Which is super interesting and sad because it's painful for them to have to go through that process. But anyways, to your point, look, I don't know what's going to happen, obviously. No one can predict these things. But I think we're in a super interesting situation right now. Now that Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the reelected prime minister of Israel, has just said definitively that he will never allow a Palestinian state to be established next to Israel. So what does that mean the next time the UN Security Council wants to pass a resolution against Israel's occupation of the West Bank, which was supposed to be temporary and Netanyahu is now saying is permanent? Well, does that mean that the U.S. is going to veto that resolution again? Because that's what Israel's been counting on for decades. You know, is unquestioning U.S. Support at the U.N. and also European support. Yeah. I mean, let's not be too
Amerocentric.
Yes, that's a good enough word for me. The Europe is Israel's biggest trading partner, and Europe has, you know, despite what Americans might say about Europe's relationship with the Jews, Europe has actually been a super loyal and supportive ally to Israel. And it is now, you know, going to have to reconsider sanctions, because it always said that as long as Israel was, you know, involved in discussions about ending the occupation, then they would protect Israel as well. They would have Israel's back. Well, that's no longer the case. You know, for most Israelis, Europe is a natural trading partner because it's, you know, you take a flight from Ben Gurion Airport, which is 20 minutes drive from Tel Aviv, and in 4 hours you're in Paris.
Right.
You know, in 5 hours you're in London, and in an hour and a half you're in Istanbul. So it's same time zone. It's going to make Israel, if all of these heavy hitting diplomatic allies and trading partners, I'm talking about Europe and I'm talking about the U.S., actually decide to stop reflexively protecting Israel in the diplomatic arena, and also if Europe imposes trade sanctions, this would isolate Israel in a very scary way. And I don't know what will happen. I think that, you know, based on my experience, I mean, I'm an Israeli, I lived in Israel for many, many years. You know, my experience is that people will just say, well, the whole world is against us. No one knows what it's like to live here. And no one knows, you know, they're misjudging us. You know, we're a country under fire. We have to protect ourselves. They might turn to, you know, other allies in more authoritarian states, Russia, China. I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating because, you know, I think, you know, not to make it about America again, but of course, it's hard for me not to have that perspective, at least to a certain extent, that I think, you know, the think pieces last week were the ones, and by last week, I mean prior to this election, were the ones that were talking about Israel and the United States having sort of agendas that may be diverging. But now it seems to me that that's a reported pieces. Like it is no longer sort of analysis to say that it is simply the fact we have these divergent agendas. It's going to be fascinating, I think.
Yep. Something's definitely shifting. But don't forget, there are some very, very powerful interests that are, really preventing any serious top-level movement in terms of bilateral diplomatic relations, and specifically regarding American foreign policy to Israel. You have, a very powerful Christian right, the evangelical Christian right, which doesn't seem to be going anywhere fast at the moment. Don't forget that, AIPAC has a lot of power. A lot of the power of AIPAC is derived from the Christian evangelical right, yeah? So I think, it's also going to be somewhat up to the American Jewish community, because American Jews tend to vote Democrat, but they're also AIPAC supporters. And there's no real contradiction there. People like to think there is, but there isn't really.
Let me ask you that, because that was actually the next thing I wanted to follow up, and I hadn't really contemplated it in those terms. But mm-hmm. I mean, here is, one wonders, where is going to be, in my, from my perspective, the way I see this playing out is mm-hmm. this becomes more of a partisan issue. It hasn't quite broken that way yet, but the Republican Party follows Bibi Netanyahu. I mean, I think now almost literally, but follows him down this road of there should be no two-state solution. That there should be no citizenship for these people, that this is somehow tenable. And at one point, the Democratic Party, there are going to be people in the Democratic Party, and I don't know if there's even one now, but there's going to be one, and then two, and then five. And we saw it a little bit with this Bibi Netanyahu speech in front of Congress, who are going to break off from this. And it is just a matter of time, it seems to me, that the base of the party and the left basically says, like, this is not, you cannot, there has to be a contradiction between AIPAC and that attitude and the left in this country. And then Israel is going to be in the biggest trouble if the Democrats ever get Congress back. But why do you not perceive a conflict between supporting AIPAC and supporting and being of the left in this country?
Well, AIPAC is an NGO. It's a lobbying organization, and it lobbies for America to support Israel in the international arena, right? That's always been a bipartisan issue in the States. So there's no conflict between being a Democrat, and American Jews tend to be very liberal on social issues. I think 75% of American Jews vote Democrat, straight Democrat.
Right.
So, but most of them, don't get me wrong, not all American Jews are involved in the community, but I think the 40s and above, they tend to be more involved in these sort of organizations. But I think that more and more, they're sort of the under 45s. They're sort of questioning this this unflinching, unswerving support for Israel as a sort of an identity totem and an emotional place. And they're looking at Israel's actions, and they're recognizing that they conflict with the values with their own values as liberal Democrats. And so they're sort of questioning this loyalty to Israel.
Indeed.
And I think that this could have some long term consequences, but it's really dicey to predict the future. But I'm just saying that looking at trends right now, we're now in the fifth generation of American Jews, the fourth generation of American Jews since the mass migration in the 1890s. People don't have a living relative who comes from the old country. And they also, the new generation, our generation, did not grow up in that kind of environment where people would, employers would place advertisements in the New York Times for a secretary saying only Christians need apply, this kind of casual country club anti-Semitism doesn't exist in America anymore. American Jews are very successful, confident, and assimilated. So they might get to the point where they're just kind of saying to Israel, bye-bye, you're not representing me anymore. I mean, that could happen. On the other hand, you have to look at also the fact that the fastest growing segment of the American Jewish community is the ultra-Orthodox community, and they do vote Republican. And they are very right-wing in Israel. So there's a lot of things to look, a lot of things to examine and keep track of.
Lisa Goldman from contributing editor to 972 magazine and Israel-Palestine analyst at Numerica Foundation. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye-bye. So there you have it.
It's a little Tea Party Nation. That's
and I should
is.
Say, one of those think pieces Michael wrote. I've read it to other places too, but credit where credit's due. Michael wrote that we're diverging piece, and he did it with a sort of a Yiddish lilt. So good for him.
Yeah, some differences, and they're getting more pronounced.
It seems to me. I'm going to be spending, I can tell you that the next 48 hours are going to be spent on an email chain that I'm going to wish I never got involved in. But I can assure you that I just, it's like a moth to light with me, right? Like I couldn't help it.
That's you. But don't, I think the other.
I have an emotional problem. That's an emotional problem.
Oh, well, that's, you know.
Right? I mean, that's an emotional problem.
Benjamin Netanyahu's a racist. Avdor Lieberman's a fascist, and Sam Cedar has emotional problems.
I'm a provocateur.
I mean, you are a provocateur.
But I mean, it's not for the sake of provocation. It's actually genuinely held belief, but it's the provocation that makes me write the email.
That makes it fun.
Yeah.
Can I? But don't you think the other big piece of this is how does very specifically this progressive except Palestine thing happen anymore? Because I mean, it's one thing to say. You know, it becomes more of a partisan issue. But I think in the future, like, and just being realist about it, Bill de Blasio needed to run the campaign he ran the last time and say what he said about Israel in order to get elected mayor of New York. There's just no question about it. But in the future, especially with any remnant of any idea about what this is coming off, how can you build a coalition the way Bill de Blasio did, or the way Elizabeth Warren is and the right-wing position she holds on Israel, or even Bernie Sanders for that matter? How can you not at least be forced to say, well, I stand with the left in Israel, or I stand with the liberals in Israel?
Well, that's
and
the
start
point.
To make an actual distinction.
That's the point. I mean,
it's
I think, listen, when Tim Kaine said that he was not going to go to Bibi Netanyahu's speech. Now, granted, I don't know what Tim Kaine's base of support is, but here's a guy who hopes to be vice president. And that decision is not made lightly. And so he sits down, he makes a calculation and just see like, what price will I pay here? And it seems to me that in the, you know, and I imagine the guy thinks this out. I mean, if you're going to, he's a bright guy, and he definitely has ambitions. And so those are the type of calculations that you make. And that to me is an indication of potential softness in support of, or I should say, yeah, I mean, potential softness in the support of a Netanyahu led Israel. And so, yes, I think the next step, the next logical step is, but you know, because it's problematic because you don't want to get involved in other people's elections, but you is to start to see this cleave. And it's going to be interesting, you know, it's going to be interesting because this is going to be a question that Hillary Clinton's going to get. And my guess is that she tends to be to the right of Obama on this.
And I think she's to the right, but don't you think she's to the right in the same way that she's just sort of assumed, like, of course I have to vote for the invasion of Iraq. Of course. And if you're her, maybe you're anticipating, maybe I don't want to always sort of be out of sync. I don't think she's not going to move to the left on this issue, but it's possible. I wonder if she might have to make a few more gestures in the context of the next party of like Palestinians are human beings. Benjamin Netanyahu is a little out of control. I support what's happening with Iran. I just wonder if that dynamic is shifting. But I think it's particularly more for progressives than for someone like Hillary Clinton.
I mean, I think, look, the costs for being sort of knee-jerk supportive of Israel as a politician are just not that great right now, except in the context of what that means for, like, let's say, the Iranian negotiations. And that's why it's not a coincidence. This all, you know, to the extent that there's any fissures, it happening around the Iranian negotiations. In a vacuum where there are no other issues, there just is not that much of an electoral cost. But it could come in terms of pressure. I mean, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But
on another real quick note, in Thomas Friedman's column today.
Please don't even say that.
We should be arming ISIS.
Of course. Of course we
That's
should.
That's his new.
Is that what he said?
He actually said, you want me to read the quote?
Well, yeah. Well, let's talk about
it
in the fun half. Because
fun. This is the fun. I would say, like, hashtag even for him on this column. He's out of
his
mind.
He's disrupting things. He's getting in there and he's breaking shite. It's the new economy, man. You get in there and disrupt it.
I just finished playing golf with Abu Baghdadi.
Boom. Here's the thing. We talked about this on the second half of the show yesterday when Glenn Beck predicted that ISIS would take over Europe and then we would have to join up with Russia so that Russia could take over Europe from ISIS.
That's right.
Okay? Well, boom, we arm ISIS so they can take over Europe and they can fight Russia. We'll just be on ISIS's side. So, I mean, look, here's the choice, I guess, is really what it comes down to. It's like, when you go to Paris and you want to go to walk down the Seine River. I don't know why I'm talking like this.
It's a very well, you're on a trip.
I'm on a trip. And the question is, if the Russians are controlling Paris or if the ISIS is controlling Paris, what is the relative difference going to be in the price of hotels? Right?
Absolutely.
So that's really, I mean, what's the difference going to be in the price of hotels? Now, on one hand, the ISIS people will probably destroy the museums. But on the other hand, you know, why feel so obligated to see a museum?
Russians are really very tacky, and from what I understand, that ISIS, you know, they drive a hard bargain, but then they stick to it.
So if the ISIS, they destroy the museums, at least you don't have to feel like, oh, we didn't get to the Jeu de Paume or whatever it was. Because you come back and everybody's like, did you see the Mona Lisa? And I just didn't feel like I wanted to do more shopping. All right. We're going to head into the fun half. Folks, so many ways you can support this program. You can go and vote for us at the Podcast Awards. We still have a couple of days left in that. I guess 2 weeks. No, 1 week of voting, right? Just 1 week of voting left.
Just 1 week.
Not even full week. Oh, my God. You got to vote for us at the Podcast Awards. And you can do it every day now, not like a 24-hour period, but a calendar day. So whenever you hear music on the Majority Report, that's your cue. It's Pavlovian now. See, there's an argument for the Russians. I'm getting silly. Vote for us for Best News in Politics at Podcast Awards. Spread around our Indiegogo campaign, which you can find at themajorityreport.com. Become a member of the show. Do all these things. If you're bathing in joy from what you get from the Majority Report, you can do all these things in one day. Become a Majority Report member at majority.fm. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, you can buy your crap from our link at majorityreportkickback.com and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Now we cue the music. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, you can IM me at Majority FM. I just fired up my IM machine. Apologies. Do it through the app. The app is free. Majority app. Wow, Lawyer Matthew, your vote has been verified. He voted today. Contribution confirmation. Lawyer Matthew, coming in strong today. I think that was also partly probably him feeling a little guilty for roping me into today's email chain with the Indie Mike.
Giving us money is like a little tiny way of getting to vote against BB. Think of it that way.
Well, it's his way of saying, like, Indie Mike is on fire today, so you gotta get in.
Okay, now I'm an independent. I would call myself a social liberal and a fiscal conservative. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
I am a social liberal unless it means that Arab-Israeli citizens get rights. So I'm a limited social liberal. I believe fully in marriage equality for gay people. However, unless they're Arab, in which case they shouldn't even be allowed to have water. All right. See you in the fun half.